So currently we're on the 56th mitzvah, which is mitzvahs bezdin ladun benizkei ha'ish, the mitzvah incumbent on the court to adjudicate cases based on the principles of damages that are caused by fire. And this is anything basically, not just fire. We know that we have what we call avos nezikin and toldos nezikin, that we have the larger categories of damages and we have the things that are derived from them. So, for example, for Aish, for fire, we have anything that you should have watched and you didn't watch. Just like if you light a fire and you weren't careful about taking the proper precautions to make sure it didn't spread. So too, like if you leave a knife lying on your roof, for example, and then a normal wind comes, not like a hurricane, but a normal wind comes and knocks it off the roof and it damages someone, so you're considered liable. So that's something that you should have been responsible for and you were not responsible for. But if, let's say, you bolted your knife to the roof and a hurricane came and ripped it off, so that's not normal. So then you're not responsible for any damage that came by the knife. So as this applies to the fire, which is the av nizikin, which is the more general category, it's ladun ulechayev ulechalem mishehizik chaveru ba'ish, that somebody, we should adjudicate properly the case of somebody who damages his friend based on fire. Kiyon shehidlik es gedisho osaraf lo shum davar. So, for example, he has his piles of produce lying around in his fields, and you light it on fire. So then he has nothing to sell anymore, he has nothing to eat, so that's bad. Or just if you go into his house and you're a pyro and you like to set things on fire, so you light something on fire that's of value, then you are considered to be chayav for that. Shenemar, ki seitze eish vegomer. So with the pasuk, as we know in the parsha of Mishpatim, is when fire goes out. Perush teitze mashma fil yatsa me'atzma. So if really what the pasuk is talking about is if the fire goes out on its own, so you're still liable. In other words, certainly kol shekein, if you actually take a match and light something on fire, then you're responsible for the damage caused. So the pasuk is telling you that you're even responsible if your fire blows off on its own and causes damage to someone else. Uvala hazir shafilu hamadlik besoch shelo. Let's say you're totally permissible that you light your own thing on fire. You want to create a bonfire in your backyard. The yotza me'atzma v'hizika shechayev, and the fire spreads on its own and causes damage, you're responsible. L'fi shelo shomar gachalto. Because you, in other words, the expression here is talking about a coal. You did a burning hot coal, that if you have something that could cause fire, you're supposed to take responsibility for it to make sure it doesn't spread. That's incumbent upon you. She'ha'adam chayev lishmor isho shelo teitzei v'tazik. You're responsible for making sure that your fires don't spread and cause damage. She'derech ha'ish aleches me'atzma, that fire can spread on its own without human intervention. Obviously, the fire is not alive, but it's still the nature of fire to spread on its own. So you have to be careful to only use fire in a very limited and careful manner, otherwise you'll be considered responsible for any damage that it causes. Shorshek yadua kemosha marnu. Again, all the damage laws, then it's just for the betterment of society. You have to make sure that society functions normally. Dinaha, the halachos of this mitzvah, kigon shir haharchaka shemarchikin be'era min hametzer, the amount of space that you have to give between, let's say you light a fire and the border of your property to a friend's property. So the shulafi gofa shaldleika, basically, you have to use common sense. You have, according to the size of the fire, you have to make sure that it stays farther away from anything that it could damage. V'din hasholcha biyad chereshote v'katan. So let's say you send a hot coal or something that could cause fire, and you give it to a deaf mute, someone who's mentally ill, or a minor, and you say, take this somewhere else. So then that causes damage. Then they're not careful with a hot coal, and it lights something on fire. So that's what we call chayav bedinei shamayim, that the earthly court does not obligate you who sent the coal to pay restitution to the person that damaged. But still, if you want to be in God's good graces, you should still pay the restitution. But there is a difference also if you send an actual fire, if you hand them a torch, than that, then you are chayav. You're responsible to actually pay for the damages because that the actual fire is there already. It doesn't just have the potential to light something on fire. Fire is there, and that's considered not watching it appropriately, giving it to someone who's not responsible to care for it properly. Opikeach, or if you send anything that could cause fire with somebody who's a regular person and doesn't suffer for any of these ailments, then you're not responsible. Then it's the obligation of the shliach, of the person that you're sending with the fire to take the proper precautions. And then that person would maintain full responsibility for any damages that he caused. V'din harabim, let's say more than one person was involved in setting the fire. She'echad hevi ha'ur, one person lit the match or brought the fire from somewhere else. Ve'echad hevi eitzim, and one person brought the fuel for the fire, literally here the wood. Ve'echad liba, and one person fanned the flames. Then basically it's the last person who is responsible. The last person who was the most directly the cause of the spread of the fire is responsible to pay the damages. But the first person, let's say somebody's just standing there with a torch and he's not moving anything, and then somebody else sticks the pile of wood into the, I don't know exactly how this works, but sticks the pile of wood into the torch, then that person would be responsible for the flames, for the damages. V'liba v'libatu haruach. So let's say you're fanning the flames, but the wind is also coming and fanning the flames. So who's responsible? Can you say that I'm not responsible at all? It's completely, there's a fire here. I didn't necessarily even set the fire. Let's say there's a fire here. And you could say the wind's going to cause it to travel. I'm not going to causing the flame to travel because the wind could do it. So basically, if the wind could blow it by itself to the place where it caused damage, so even if you happen to be fanning it also, then you're not responsible. But if your power and the wind's power combine to cause the fire to spread to the place where it caused damage, then you are to be held completely responsible. V'din kelim t'munin bagadisho t'munim abira. So let's say there are vessels which the person hid in a pile of grain or in some sort of other cabinet, and you set fire to it. So the rule is, if it's something that's normally placed there, then you are responsible. But if it's something that's totally not normally placed there, and you would have no way to assume that any of such thing could possibly be there, and it got destroyed, then you're not considered responsible. So let's say somebody hid their precious manuscripts from 1,000 years ago underneath his pile of grain, and you set fire to the grain. He says, "Oh, you know, I lost out on $500 of grain due to your fire, but there were $700,000 of manuscripts there. Those are worth, so you have to pay me the $700,000. What? How was I supposed to know that you hid? That's not normal to hide manuscripts in a pile of grain. So you're not responsible to pay for the manuscripts. But if you set fire to someone's cabinet at home and there happens to be manuscripts in there, then you certainly are. Where else should I put it? Of course, I would keep my precious belongings in there. However, it's interesting, though, that let's say this person did keep his precious belongings in the pile of grain and you set fire to it. So you don't get completely off scot-free. You view the manuscripts as if they were part of the pile of grain. So in other words, if you have a pile of wheat or something, and there is 3 tons of wheat, and there's a few pounds of precious. I really go by volume, probably, but anyway, I'm just using this to make it easier. But if there's a few pounds of precious possessions at the hidden in the bottom of the pile, so you don't say, "Oh, I just have to pay the 5 tons of grain. I have to, and I'm getting off scot free." No, you add the extra few pounds of manuscripts that were there as if they were really a part of the pile of produce that you set fire to. V'din gamal over ton pishtan. So let's say you're walking through the marketplace and you have a camel which has flax loaded on its back, and flax is something that's extremely flammable. So v'dolka b'ner chen v'nimadino. So let's say it passes by a storefront, and the store owner has candles. So what happens? So this is the Mishnah in Bava Kama. at the end of the sixth parak tells us that if you took your camel into the store and it caught on a fire, then you're responsible. The owner of the camel is responsible for any damage that this caused. And certainly the store doesn't have to pay for the flax that caught fire from this person's camel. But if the store owner left his candle at the front of the store, at the entrance of the store, and the camel walks by and catches fire, then the store owner is responsible, because the store owner shouldn't have put his candle in a place where it could have caused damage, because people are walking by with their animals and their loads all the time. And there in the Mishnah, there's a disagreement between the Tanakhama, the origin of the first person anonymous speaker in the Mishnah, and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda adds on that, let's say, there is a one case where store owner is perfectly legitimate in putting a candle outside, and that's on Hanukkah. So on Hanukkah, we know really the way it's supposed to be is you're supposed to, it sounds very weird to us nowadays, but really the way it's supposed to be in Hanukkah is that you're supposed to put the candle next to the door, on the outside of the door, next to the doorpost. So Rabbi Yehuda says over there that the store owner would not have to pay if the camel caught fire on the Hanukkah candle. But the Tanakhama disagrees, and most people pass like the Tanakhama. But if you look here, the Sefer HaChinuch continues, O b'ner Hanukkah, and he says, what's the halacha regarding if the camel catches on a ner Hanukkah? So some of the commentators on the Sefer HaChinuch point out that since the Sefer HaChinuch brought ner Hanukkah as a special case, according to the Tanakhama, the halacha of ner Hanukkah is the same as any other candle, that if the camel catches fire on it, then the store owner has to pay. But since the Sefer HaChinuch brought it as a special case, implying that it has a different set of halachos, he seems to say that he paskins like Reb Yehuda, that he paskins that he's putter, which is against most of the poskim, but it's interesting that maybe the Sefer HaChinuch paskins like Reb Yehuda. The rest of the details of this halacha, the second and sixth parak of Bava Kama, the end of Mitzvah Nunvav. Because again, we see that men are the ones who are responsible to judge, but of course the halachos that comprise the body of obligations represented by Eish, by the damages of fire, of course, are equally applicable to men and women. A woman is not allowed to go into someone else's field and light it on fire. Ovezdin ha'over alea velo dan ha'mazik b'tashlumim k'moshe kasu b'talasei. And the Bezdin that neglects to extract the appropriate financial restitution from the person who caused damage, it has nullified and neglected to perform a mitzvah zasei, a positive commandment, and that is bad. So now we pretty much finished all the major categories of damages, and we're going to get to a slightly different area, but not too different, and that's going to go on for a while, which is the Shomrim. There'll be a little respite at the next mitzvah, but you'll see in a second. But we're going to talk about the different types of guardians, or what'd you say, Bailey? Was that?
Bailey.
Yeah, that's what we used when we were studying. We were studying Perek Hamafket earlier, before, as the predecessor to the Sefer HaChinuch Shir, we were discussing Baileys and we were discussing Shomrim. So that's what we call the Sansino translation, and the Art Scroll probably uses a simpler English word to translate Shomer. I remember once I was reading an article by, I forget which one it was, by Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. So he writes, if you'll consult an accurate translation of the Talmud, such as the Sansino. Anyway.
That was an old article.
Actually, that was Steinsaltz.
Well, it was after Art Scroll had already been published. Art Scroll. Okay, so Mitzvah Nun Zayin, the 57th mitzvah, is Mitzvah's Bezdin Lodun Bedin Shomer Chinam. The mitzvah incumbent on the Bezdin to do the appropriate court actions when somebody watches an object for free. So, ladun bedin shomer chinam, to judge according to halacha of a shomer chinam, a free watcher, free bailey. Shademar ki tein ish al reyu kesef okelim lishmor. So, when a person gives to another money or vessels to watch, Ubahapeirush sheparshes onemra b'shomer chinam. The accepted explanation of this pasuk is that the Torah is here referring to someone who does not take money for his services as to guard somebody else's objects.
Why is it again that the Sefer Chinuch is talking about the mitzvah on the Beis Din? It seems like the mitzvah is in fact upon the parties involved. The mitzvahs are not. Doesn't
why?
Well,
you don't have to be a Shomer Chinam. There's no mitzvah that you have to be a Shomer.
If you were a Shomer Chinam, then and in this condition, mm-hmm. The Jordan Khan Shomer is liable to pay. The Beis Din is the ones that adjudicates it, but the mitzvah is upon the person who's who owes the money or you have to pay. Is that?
Well, sort of, yes, but the payment has to really, unless you do a settle outside of court, the payment, all the things such as taking a shvua, taking an oath when necessary, all these things have to be in the context of the Beis Din. So we really don't find that the actual halacha that the Torah prescribes about these people could be applied outside of a Beis Din. So the real halacha is if you want to settle outside of Beis Din with a different way, there's no problem with that necessarily. Mm-hmm. If the two parties agree, but mm-hmm. when the case comes to Beis Din, so the Beis Din has to adjudicate it in a certain way. Lefikach patar bo es hagneva. So that's why the Torah says over here, they gunav mi beis hoish, and it says something the stuff was stolen, and the Torah exempted the Bailey from paying. So why should that be? Because the guy's doing the other guy a favor, so you can't be so hard on him. Nobody would do each other favors if they knew that they'd be totally responsible for every single damage that could possibly come to this object. But you can't impose such a standard on somebody who's watching an object for free. Uperush chinam. The explanation of chinam is in Shomer chinam. Hu shelo kibel hanifkad shum schar. That the person watching it, the Bailey, did not receive any payment whatsoever al shmiras hapikadon, to watch the object. Dineha, sure as yadua, again, the reasoning is the same, so society functions properly. Dineha, kegon hatoin tainas ganav bepikadon. So let's say the Bailey claims that the object was stolen. Benishba, and of course he has to take an oath for this, that's what the Torah prescribes, he has to take a biblical oath. The placing the power of your oath with the object that you're holding on to. That's called Nikitas Chefetz in the Lashon of Chazal. Then that's a biblical oath. And there are some rabbinic oaths that are patterned on this, that you have to swear Nikitas Chefetz. And there are some rabbinic oaths that are much more lax in their standards, which we'll get to more in the next mitzvah, which is called the Shuas Heses. But this is a real biblical shvua. V'achar kach bo edim shu birshu. So then, even though I swore that it got stolen, witnesses now came and said that, no, what do you mean? It's not. It's still there. I saw it in the guy's house just the other day. So in that case, the person would have to pay, the bailey would have to pay kefil. The person would have to pay tashlume kefil because he stole it. It's considered to be a form of stealing, so he has to pay double restitution for the object that he claimed was stolen and swore falsely, and he actually kept it himself. So the chazar v'tan tainas ganav, and then, so the object's still there, and the guy, I don't know why the guy didn't take back his object right away, but the person who owns the object kept it with the guy, and he said, I want it back again, and then the bailey said, no, it was stolen again. Again, v'chazer v'tantan is ganav v'nishba, and he took another oath. V'achar kach bo edim shu birshu. So, and again, the witnesses came and said, "No, you still have it." So you pay kefil again. That's the halacha. You could pay kefil unlimited number of times. That you swear that it was stolen, you still really have it, and the guy asked for it back. He swear it again.
Recidivism here. Why is it necessary for the Sefer Chinuch to go and say that, you know, if you do it again, you've got to pay again? I mean, isn't it obvious? It seems,
Look, it's the same object. You might think that since it's just lying around, like double jeopardy. He didn't do anything. He just kept it lying around in his house. But every time he takes the oath, falsely, that it was stolen, he has to pay a new kefil. It's a good get-rich-quick scheme for the owner of the object. V'din to'en taina saveda. So let's say, the same thing happens, by the way, if you claim that the object was lost, not just stolen, but if the object was lost and then the witnesses come and testify that you stole it, you still pay the kefil. Bechazer v'tantayin is gana v'nishba. So let's say here there's no intervening thing. You say you take an oath that it was lost, and then you. Right, I'm sorry. So if you take an oath that it was lost, and then again you take an oath that it was stolen, you changed your mind, then and then the witnesses come once again, and they say that this object is still in your possession. So in that case, you are exempt. In that case, you do not have to pay with each time. You got off scot-free the first time that you claimed, because no witnesses contradicted you after the first time. You swore that it got lost, and that's what we're assumed to believe. So then you took, by the time you swore falsely that it was stolen, you didn't, you had no obligation to pay a kefil already. So there's no recurring penalty. V'din toentain is ganav v'pikodon shel katan. And let's say the thing belonged to a minor and you claim that it was stolen, then you're also exempt from paying. Mara learns it out from the psukim. V'yeser protea, the rest of the details. Mivor meperek chi min kama, the ninth perek of Mas'a Bava Kama, u'shlishi mi metziah, and the third perek of Metziah, u'shmini mi shavuos, and there's eighth perek of Shavuos, where, of course, we're going to discuss more of the details about the actual oaths that you have to swear in this regard. V'noeges v'chol makom u'v'chol zman, it's applicable in all places and all times. U'vezdin ha'over alei abitel aseh, again, a bezdin who does not execute this adjudication, they have neglected to fulfill a positive commandment. Now, mitzvah nun ches, you'll see, the 58th mitzvah is rather lengthy. And it's basically the entire Choshen Mishpat condensed into one page. All the possible cases of cases that one person could bring against the other, another person. And the Minchas Chinuch writes, and his first comment on this mitzvah, Dinim Elu Yavru Yachlofu Melo Rochav Yam HaTalmud. These halachos are interspersed and travel throughout the entire breadth of the sea of the Talmud. Uposkim, and the poskim. Al Kain Mashachti Yodi Milachosvam. For that reason, I have restrained myself from writing about them. So you'll see that even though there's a gigantic chinuch on this mitzvah, there is not so much minchas chinuch because there's so many topics that he covers in here. He says, "Mashachti yodi milakosvam." I'm not going to go into it that much. So the 58th mitzvah is mitzvahs bezdin lodun bedin toen v'chofer. To the mitzvah of the bezdin to adjudicate disputes of somebody who brings a suit. A toin is somebody, a plaintiff, somebody who brings a suit against someone else. Mm-hmm. And kofer is someone who denies the truth of the claims of the plaintiff. A kofer literally means to deny. That's why we call a kofer somebody who denies God a kofer also. Shenitztavinu ladun bedin toin v'nitan, that we were commanded to adjudicate according to the rules of a plaintiff and a defendant. 58, mitzvah 58. Nun ches. Kelomar, shenasa din lechol mi shetoveha eschavero bishum davar. That we should appropriately adjudicate any dispute that somebody brings, a suit that somebody brings to against another person. O shehil vahu, or he lent to him. O hifkido, or put something in his care. O gzalo, or stole from him. O ashako, that he took the money peaceably, but then refused to give it back. O chamaso, or took the money forcibly. Shenemar, al kol devar pesha, according to anything, so it's asher yarshiyun Elohim. Elohim here is a secular word, it refers to the court. Asher yomar ki huzeh, that anything that the court decides should be followed. Uvaha perush, so the accepted and tradition of interpretation on this language of kihuze, this is that. She'ein nishboin min ha-Torah, ele im kein yode ha-nidba b'miktsas ha-halva. that on when you have a simple suit, interpersonal civil case, the only time that you would take an oath on a biblical level is if the defendant admits that he owes the plaintiff part of what the plaintiff is asking for, but not the whole thing. Aval im yomar lo hayu dvarim me'olam, you are saying total outright falsehood. We had no such case against each other ever. O hechzarti akol, or you're right, we did have such agreement between each other, but I paid back everything I owe you. B'milva b'afidu b'pikadon, whether with a loan or some watching something. Potter mishvua min haTorah. So on a biblical level, he's exempt from the shvua. V'zeu she'amru zichronam livracha b'gemara. The Talmud tells us dechi ksiv ki uzeh, when the Torah says ki uzeh, milvahu dechsiv, that is talking about a loan. Kilomar al tainas malve shehi amilvas shehi praticha oloha yudvar me'olam, that is talking about a claim of the defendant regarding a loan, which is either I already paid back everything, or that such a thing never existed. Aval taina shomrim shi taina ones, but when you're talking about the halachos of Bailey's, which is a claim of it was forced out of my hand, I had no control over the fact that this object got lost, o gneva, or was stolen, afilim yode b'miktsas, even if he does admit some of the case, ela yomar hakol nenas chayav lishava. So even if he says everything, was nenas, was taken away forcibly, then he has to take a shua. Well, pasuk zeh nichlu kol atvius bein shebein bnei adam shi kanes beinam ha'odah ve'akrasha. In this pasuk, we include everything, all the types of suits which could be between one person and another, which could possibly contain the concepts of either the person admits that he owes the other person money, or he denies owing the person money at all. Shorsha adinim yadua. And the reasoning for this, all these halachos, is known. Okay. Dineha, the halachos, kigon mode miktsas shenishba midaraisa. So we already pointed out that on a biblical level, it's only if somebody admits part of the suit against him that he takes the biblical oath. Perush mode bepruta v'chover b'shnei moin kesef. So we have a tradition about this matter that it's a minimum if the person admits that he owes the other guy a pruta, which is the weight of half a barley in silver, how much that's worth, and he denies the claim of the plaintiff that he owns another 2 ma'in of silver, which is the 32 barley's weight of pure silver. So a considerable amount more than the amount that he... I mean, it doesn't have to be proportional, but these are the minimum amounts that the person that has to be subject to the dispute in the way that they would be take a biblical oath. Depachos mikain eino nishba midaraisa, Ela imkein meid kenegdo. Eid meid kenegdo. So the only other way to take a biblical oath is if the plaintiff has one witness claiming that the defendant owes the money. Normally, it's only an open and shut case if there are two witnesses. Then the Beis Din just adjudicates it in paskins based on what the two witnesses say. But if the fellow has one witness, then the defendant has to take a biblical oath because the one witness is not believed to take them to extract the money from the defendant, but it's a little bit of a stronger case than zero witnesses. So in that case, the defendant can take a biblical oath that no, he does not owe this money that this one witness is testifying to, and that's it. He gets off scot-free. Interestingly, we were studying, middle of Chosh Mishpat, not the middle, towards the beginning still, but we're learning about the way the Beis Din is supposed to operate in their disputes, and if one witness comes, the Beis Din is not supposed to tell the defendant that we don't believe one witness. So if one witness comes and testifies that the defendant, really for either party, that if one witness comes in support of either party, so we just hope that the other person is going to say, oh, the one witness got me. He's not going to, he's going to give up the case, and hopefully he's going to admit that what the one witness said is true. But there's a difference of agreement amongst the commentators exactly how much the court is allowed to help the other party with his case. In other words, to tell him the information that really he could just say, technically he could just say, no, we don't believe one witness. I'm continuing in my case. But hopefully we're just going to hope that one witness will be sufficient for the other guy to admit that he was lying, if in fact that he was. So shenishba afilu b'chofer b'pachus mishnei mayin. So even if you deny that you owe less than two mayin, which is not the case for if you were modib but miksas, if you admitted part of the case. So if there's one witness, then you still have to take an oath. B'pachus mipruta, if one witness testifies that you owe less than a pruta, which is a very small amount, eino nishba l'olam elim kein. Tano Kalim. So if he just says you owe me less than a pruta, so even if in or other circumstances he might be required to take an oath, on less than a pruta, he doesn't go to the trouble of taking an oath because against such a small amount of money.
How could something less than pruta even come before a beis din? Isn't that because it would be too insignificant to be?
That's a good point. That your beis din is only allowed to really start a case if the amount under dispute is more than a pruta. But we do also have a principle that if they start the proceedings for a case that's more than a shavet pruta, then if somehow in the that a discussion comes up or if the value decreases or something, or that's, that might be a dispute. But if somehow they get to start talking about something that's less than a pruta, they can continue the proceedings for that. So the only way that you would be chayav shvua is if you were talking about a specific vessel that was worth less than a pruta. So it's a concrete thing rather than an amount of money. Let's say a person says, you owe me two needles, and the two needles together are worth way less than a pruta. They're total, basically worthless. So if he says that you owe me two needles, and the person says, no, I only owe you one needle, so he does take a biblical oath, because since you could, something you can sink your teeth into, that it's a whole needle that he owes, then you do take a shvua. So also the rules of taking a shvua d'oraisa are only applicable if the amount under discussion is something that's countable, that's either based on a volume or something that's countable or weighable. But if the two people are discussing things in two different terms, then you don't take a shvua d'oraisa. So for example, somebody says, the plaintiff says, you owe me $500. And the person says, no, you gave me a sack of money. You just gave me a sack of money, not a particular amount. You gave me a sack, so I have to give you the sack of money back. So he did admit that he owes the guy money, but since they're not speaking in the same number of things, it's an indeterminate quantity, then that's not considered a modib mikzas to the extent that he would have to take a shvua d'oraisa. That's one example. But then kofar bakol, so that the court proceedings have to proceed as normal without a shua if the guy doesn't admit to owing anything. The hoda mi min hataina, and of course with the hoda has to be on the type of thing that the plaintiff was talking about. The hoda is baldin, so let's say the person goes ahead and admits that he owes a certain amount of money, even just volunteers the information in general to a beis din, then that's considered kameya edim dami. They don't need, he can't go, you know, the person has a right to demand the money because he's considered to have already caused himself to lose the money by admitting to his own guilt, so to speak. V'dinei shomrim, the halachos of Baileys, that have all their many different details. U'mechuyav shvua d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, and it would depend on different things, or a shvua d'oraisa on a biblical level and only on a rabbinic level. V'dinei nishba v'niftar, there are certain cases where the person takes a shvua and he's exempt. So that's the case if you take a shvua d'oraisa in this case that you don't have to pay. The defendant takes the shvua, he doesn't have to pay the whole amount, and he doesn't have to pay. B'nishba b'notel, there's certain other cases where you have to take, where the person who's requesting the money takes the oath, and then he swears that the guy actually does owe him that amount of money, and he gets to take that amount of money. B'din choshud al ha-shvua, but there are certain cases, so basically the rule is that if someone's pasul eidus, so he commits either he's known to swear falsely, or he commits sins that would render him not to be a valid witness. So he's considered choshed al shua. He's suspect regarding oaths, and he's not valid to take a shua. So if he has to take a shua, then he lost out. Mm-hmm. Too bad. You can't testify to your own innocence in this case, because you can't take the oath because you're choshed. The puchei shvua, and there's certain cases, especially with rabbinic oaths, that the defendant might have to take a shvua, and he could say, "No, I'm not willing to take the oath. I don't admit to the case that's being brought against me, but I don't admit to the case that's being brought against me. I'm nervous about taking an oath. I'm nervous about mentioning the name of God and everything, and swearing on a sefer Torah. So I don't really want to take the oath, so you take the oath, but once you take the oath that I owe you that amount of money, then I'll have to pay you." And he'll recognize that if the plaintiff does in fact take the oath in the end, then he'll have to pay. But that's the way it works. Ubeiza avera nase choshud, which type of sin renders you invalid to swear? Like I said, basically if you violate any negative commandment of the Torah. If you receive, which type of tshuva will make you again be able to take a shvua? So that's if you receive your malchus, if you receive your lashes as a penalty for violating the negative commandment, then that restore and you the Bezdin sees that you're now a good person and you stop doing the thing that you used to do, then you are now restored to your good graces and you could take an oath. No, we don't. Umi shelo noda shu chashud. So somebody that it wasn't known that this person was not valid to take an oath, and v'zocha b'mamon b'shuaso. So in his oath caused someone to get money. Ve'charkach bo edim, and then witnesses came. She chashud haya shechayev lahachzer amamon. So then this person took a shvua. Let's say he collected the debt, because he swore that the guy owed him the money. So then witnesses came and said, "No, you were invalid to take a shvua." The Bezdin didn't know. So then the guy has to return the money. Because you might think that, you know, once it's done, it's done. So a lot of times we have higher standards for removing money from a particular ownership and giving it to someone else. So and then you see that it's completely invalid, the oath. It's as if it was never done. U'mechuyev shvua she'enu yochol lishava madino. And if somebody is obligated to take an oath and he cannot take an oath for whatever reason, so what's the halacha? Basically that it's as if the oath was not done. So you proceed as if the person who's supposed to take the oath could not offer anything in his defense. V'dine migu, if certain times somebody, you believe someone because they could have had a better claim, but they chose to do the lesser claim, but they could have just as easily have taken a bigger claim. So you assume that they're telling the truth. V'dine bari v'shema. Let's say one guy claims that for sure you owe me the money. Then the person responds, "Well, I'm not sure. You know, maybe I'm not. Maybe I do. Maybe I don't." So there are sometimes different halachos that govern such cases. Although he could take a shua that he is not sure, in which case to proceed according to the verdict of that shua, since he's not sure. So the shua that case is not powerful enough to take the money out of someone's ownership and transfer it to someone else. V'dine gilgul shvua. So the concept of gilgul shvua is that if you are in a case that requires the taking of a shvua, and since you are already taking a shvua about something else, or certain other things that come up in that case, then you could force the person who has to take the oath anyway to swear about the other things, even if those other things wouldn't by themselves. Gilgul shvua.
What is that?
That's causing, if something else is under discussion, then it wouldn't engender a shvua up by itself, but since this guy has to take a shvua for something else, so you include this. Bain bari al bari al shema, whether it's taina, one's a sure claim and regarding a sure claim, or maybe a not sure claim, ba'filu shema al shema, sometimes the even including another not so sure claim with another, the not so sure claim. B'chol inyan shua magalgaling. Anything regarding that's the shua, you could do a gilgul shua. B'chol inyan shua yesh gilgul bein deraiso derabanan. So in any type of thing that would require a an oath, you could do a Gilgal Shvuah, whether it's on a biblical level or a rabbinic level. Ve'afilu shi'takanas achronim, even if it's not even required by the strict Talmudic law, but was just something that the later authorities enacted for the betterment. They felt that such a thing was necessary in their times to make sure society functioned properly. We could do a Gilgal Shua. V'dinei hatainis she'anu danin hanitba kemeshiv aveda. There are certain cases where the plaintiff doesn't really have such a strong case. And the nitba, so if anything that the defendant is going to give the plaintiff or take part in his case is sometimes considered, we treat him very leniently and we say, give what you take what you can get, Mr. Plaintiff. That is considered as if the nitba is simply returning a lost object. Doesn't even have the status really of a defendant. Because the plaintiff doesn't have such a strong case, so it's as if he's just offering to give it back, as if the guy lost the money. Yeah. That dvarim she'ein nishba'in aleihem din Torah. So there are certain things that if you dispute about them, so you don't take an oath, and those are such things as land, slaves, not objects, basically. Shtaros, also documents. Somebody steals your documents or something like that. Uperos shigiu la katofim imdinon kakarka linyan shvua. So you'd think that fruit, while it's still attached to the ground, would be considered like land and not like objects. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't take an oath regarding those fruits. But there are certain types of fruit that are totally ready for picking. That are just happen to still be attached to the ground, but they're ready for people to come pick already. So those fruits are considered detached from the ground already, even though they're physically attached because they don't really need the ground to continue growing. They're done growing.
Wait a second. If there's a dispute over ownership of land,
yeah,
the Beis Din can certainly adjudicate it. It's just not that
right. No, right. There's no shua. Right.
Exactly.
No shua. Interestingly, this concept also has an application in Hilchos Pesach, sort of. It's not exactly analogous, but it's the same idea. That if a grain is still attached to the ground and it rains, grain is still growing, so it doesn't become chametz because it's still in the process of growing, it's still receiving its nutrition from the ground. But if it's completely developed and ready for harvesting, even though it's still attached to the ground, if water comes into contact with the grain could become chametz because it's no longer receiving its nutrition from the ground. It's completely ready to be detached from the ground. What? Tumah. That's not Tumah. I'm talking about chametz. So that's why a lot of people want to make matzah from wheat that was grown in Arizona.
Right.
Because in Arizona, it doesn't really rain, so there's no problem for this whatsoever. Okay? Chumras? Incidentally, this is why, by the way, why in Israel, the Gemara tells us that it's only, according to the way the most poskim understand it, is that shmura matzah, to watch the grain for so far before it even gets turned into bread, either from the harvesting or from the grinding, to watch the grain to make sure no water comes in it to become chametz, that's really only, according to the strict halakha, that's only a chumra for the matzah that you eat at the Seder to fulfill the mitzvah, because it says ushmartim es hamatzos. But for the rest of the matzah, you could really take, whether it's lechatchila or not, it's a different question, but at least in an ex post facto situation, you could take just flour from the regular flour that's sold in the store and make matzah of it. Nowadays you can't because they wet the grain before they turn it into flour, but in the olden days when they didn't, as a matter of course, wet the grain before they ground it into flour, if they needed to, they would just buy flour from the marketplace and make matzah with it for the rest of the days of Pesach. So the Vilna Gaon was extremely makbid to eat only. So that's because that's an Eretz Yisrael in Bavel, so it's dry at this time of year. So there's no concern that it would rain on the grain while it was still attached to the ground and not needing the nutrition from the ground anymore. So the Vilna Gaon was said to be extremely, extremely makbid to have only shmura matzah all Pesach, to have grain that was, to have matzahs baked from grain that was watched from the time of harvesting. So some people point to this and say, well, you see that the Vilna Gaon held that the halacha is that you have to have shmura matzah the entire Pesach. You should not eat any matzah Pesach besides matzah made from grain that was watched from the time of harvesting. And there is a shita like that in the Rishonim. The Rambam says that at least lechatchila, an ideal situation, you should eat only shmura grain for the entire Pesach. But even he says it's not an absolute requirement. So people say that you see that the Vilna Gaon holds that it's an absolute requirement. You have to eat shmura matzah the entire Pesach. The answer is that's not the case at all. The answer is that in Europe it's much rainier than it is in Eretz Yisrael. So there was much more reason to be concerned that the grain would be chametz before it was even processed into flour. So nowadays people think that they are going to be so stringent, they're going to follow the Vilna Gaon, that they have to have shmura matzah the entire Pesach. That's not really true. Well, for our matzah that's grown in Eretz Yisrael in similar climates, so for the rest of the Pesach, not for the Seder, so it's completely fine. Lechatchila, to have non-shmura matzah. The Omer lechavero, and somebody says to his friend, "Shtar biyodach uzchus yesh libo." There is a, among your collection of documents, there is a document with a that shows that I owe, that someone else owes me money, or that I don't owe someone else money, or something along those lines. Im kofin oso lehotzio. If you force the person in whose document collection this document happens to be residing, to bring it out, because really people don't want the people for no reason someone to see their personal business, to see all their documents and money that people owe them. So you really have no right, even if you think something is relevant to you, you have no right to force this person to go show the best in his documents. What you can do, it says in Shulchan Aruch, is that you could declare what you call machrim stam, that you get up and you say, basically, declare with all the power vested in you that anyone who has a document that shows that I, that is something good for me in it and is not showing it, should be in cherem, should be excommunicated. I hope that person drills it into the person's head that he should, if he really is, so he should show, he has to show the document. V'din ha'boli para shelo bifnei ha'malve. So let's say the guy wants to pay back the money and the lender is not there. V'din malve al hamashkon. So let's say you lend out money and you take a collateral. The avad hamashkon, you lost the collateral. Im cholkin ze im ze b'minyan mos ha'milva. So how much do you deduct that from the, what's the burden of proof, first of all? And second of all, what exactly is the calculation of deducting the value of the collateral from the collection? We discussed this also a little bit in Perek Hamafkid. V'din hamalva v'yishuv rotzel l'thora b'midbar. Let's say you originally lent the money in a city, and then you wanted the lender wants to pay back in the desert. V'din lovesh omer parati mechza. The lender says that I paid you back half of what I owe you. V'ha'idim idim sheparo kulo. And then he has witnesses that say, no, you paid back the whole thing. So we believe the witnesses. Sorry, even the guy says, no, I still owe half. You believe the witnesses, and that's one of the cases where that's considered more like a meshiv aveda, where the plaintiff really has no case, but if you want to pay back the extra that you think you owe, so that's like a meshiv aveda, if you know that to be true. V'din lo v'mode b'shtar sheksavo v'toen shepro im tzorech l'kaimo hamalva. So the lender says that, that's an accurate document, but that shows that you lent me money, but I paid you back already. So then the question is, if the lender now has to go collect proof that these witnesses on the document are true, and then if he has this document, there's no actual proof that the guy paid back, so maybe the lender still has to pay back. V'din shtar she lova bo pro. So let's say there's a document that you used to lend to borrow money and you paid it back. V'din sholeach mona biyad shliach lemish neschayev lo vo lachzer bo. So let's say you send someone to pay back money for you and then you change your mind. V'din tainas parua b'shtar she biyad shlish. Let's say you claim that's a document that's in the hands of someone else, has already been paid back, the loan that it's represented and then has paid back. V'din shtar shein bo makom bo zmanim kosher, a document that does not have the date and the place in it is not to be considered a kosher document. And, okay, this list does not seem to be coming to any particular end here, so...
I mean, did you leave anything important out?